Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. On location, have a lot of good information to share, and it's going to be impacting people all over the world. We're not just a local station. We are the number one progressive voice in the world. So there's a reason that people come here, and that is because they want to be empowered. They want to have information and insights that you're not going to find in the other media, and you'll see you're going to get that today. Because I am going to talk about Dr. Gary Coles, a retired physician, publishing an article in Global Research, one of the most respected reference guides, about what we call this Semmelweis reflex, meaning rejecting new medical evidence, quote, because it contradicts and refutes established norms. Now, this affects everyone in this audience because you assume when you go to the doctor that because of the discipline, the dedication, and more often than not, the ideals that the young medical student, intern, resident, and then into practice or specialization, that they have only your best interest, that they're open-minded, that if there's good, solid science that supports doing away with something that may not be efficacious or safe and implementing something that is better, they're going to do that. That's what we've been led to believe. You'll find later it's simply not true. But we always start with the latest on health and healing. And I want to start with something that impacts a lot of people. That's Parkinson's disease. Now, there's an article in Science magazine that shows the benefit of taking different antioxidant therapies against neurodegenerative disease. Now, just so you understand, in human neurons derived from Parkinson's disease patients, a group of scientists discovered that the neurons were being affected adversely, mainly the mitochondria. Now, I've mentioned many, many, many times that the mito, M-I-T-O, chondria, C-H-O-N-D-R-I-A, mitochondria, when they oxidize, meaning they die or they're damaged, you're no longer able to have the same energy. And that's why frequently when we have cancer, diabetes, neuropathy, heart disease, we just don't have that energy. And so we stay in a kind of a fatigued, functional fatigue. We're able to go to work. We're able to function. We just don't have that hyper energy we once had, that we could go out and go dancing or do things and be constantly physically alert. And that's because of mitochondrial stress. And that leads in turn to oxidized dopamine accumulation. This in turn results in a reduction in the activity of an enzyme known as lysosomal glucosyrobrosidase, which weakens the function of the cells. Now, it's that simple. Now, it's complicated in the chemistry, but it's simple to understand. So the research found that the treatment with two different antioxidants, including N-acetylcysteine, or NAC, interrupted that negative cascade. Quote, from the article, one of the key strategies that worked in our experiments is to treat dopamine neurons early in the toxic cascade with specific antioxidants that improve mitochondrial oxidant stress and lower oxidized dopamine. With this approach, we found that we can attenuate or prevent the downstream toxic effects in human dopaminic neurons. So, what's that mean in lay language? It means that if we were to have any form of neurological distress leading to Parkinson's or, for that matter, any other condition, and if we were to take something as simple as N-acetylcysteine, generally 500 to 1,000 milligrams once or twice a day, then we could reasonably expect an improvement in our condition. And, of course, we should always be taking vitamin C. Now, mind you, what happens then if you're being helped, guided by a holistic nurse or nutritionist or physician, and instead of one nutrient, you're given 30. And instead of staying on the standard American diet, you're changing over to a high organic, nutrient-rich, plant-based diet. And instead of having all the fats, including peanut oil and canola oil and these other highly refined oils, frequently made from genetically engineered product, that you're taking coconut oil and linseed oil, hemp oil, and olive oil. You're taking those oils that are rich in the omega-3 fatty acids, which protect neurons, protect your brain cells, in fact, protect brain function, and also turn off inflammation, which is a byproduct of oxidative stress. So let's put all this together, see if it makes sense. It takes years, sometimes decades, before we see the accumulative damage, the buildup of the amyloid plaque in our brains, possibly microstrokes so minor that we're not even aware we've had a stroke. Possibly the lack of exercise and a bad diet, maybe even smoking or drinking, which has caused the damage to the inside of our arteries. And that causes a destruction of the epithelium. And also we've been under stress. Now all these things together create a massive, massive amount of oxidative stress. But we're not doing anything to change it. So imagine instead of taking one nutrient, antioxidant like NAC, which is very important, we just change everything. We begin to exercise, we take mindful meditation or yoga classes or Tai Chi. We start getting some body therapy, maybe mind-body therapy. We begin to eat and juice consciously. We begin to clean up our environment. Now we've made a radical, radical shift towards turning off oxidants, stressors, and flooding the body with healing nutrients. So then it's reasonable to suggest that these massive changes can both slow down, prevent, if we did them early in life, or reverse neurodegenerative conditions. And that's why when you've heard people on this program like Thomas, the 70-year-old engineer, who African-American, who had full-scale Parkinson's so bad that on the introduction night where we film everyone coming up and saying, my name is such and such, this is my age, and here are the conditions I'm now suffering from that have been medically diagnosed. Here's the treatment I'm under. Here are the drugs I'm on, whatever it is. And then a month, 3 months, a year later, year and a half later, we film the same person. And you see remarkable differences. Myasthenia gravis. In fact, the woman who suffered from myasthenia and her husband came to my recent dance party. You couldn't have missed him. She's in her mid-80s, dancing. You would think she's completely healthy in every respect. And yet 20 years ago, she was near death. And she did it all. She didn't cheat. Her husband and her worked together as a team, he being very supportive of her. Today, she's living a normal life. Thomas, on the final day of our brain program, which was 16 months, his hands were as steady as a rock. He's standing there and he's showing us his hands. And he said, I used to have someone help feed me because I couldn't bring a fork of food to my mouth. I would miss my mouth, the food would fall off. But I said, I'm going to deal with this. And he did. And he also couldn't brush his teeth, things we take for granted he couldn't do because his tremors were so extreme. Now, there was a side effect, and this is the first time I'd ever heard this from anyone I'd work with. I said when he was going through all the things that have changed, his blood pressure, which had been high, came down, his blood sugar came down to normal, his biochemistry was terrific. And he said, but there is something that's going on, and I don't know whether it's a problem or not. And I said, what's that? He said, I have now a memory I didn't have before. I said, what do you mean? He said, well, I suddenly remember everything from my past. And I said, well, give us an example. He's asked me any question. I said, all right, what year did you graduate from high school? Instantly, he said, how many people were in your homeroom class? He gave me the number. Can you give me any of their first names? He gave me their first and last names. Now, mind you, this is right off top of his head. I call that acute memory, which means, excuse me, sorry. What it means is that we have rebuilt the circuitry in his brains. We have reconnected and grew new the dendritic connections between neurons. We have re-stimulated a new pathway and re-energized this synaptic terminals. So, in effect, he was growing a new brain, something that historically we were told was simply not possible. Now we know it is. So that was just one example. But each person had a different example. And that's not because they took one nutrient. It's because they made major changes. And part of what we have a hard time with in our societies is coming to grips making radical changes. What do I mean? Everything that the average person does with their diet is extremely radical and hence destructive. Everything is pro-inflammatory. It's got the wrong pH. It causes the wrong pH in your body, which can cause pain. So we're doing it all wrong. That's highly radical. So to do highly radical positive, it's almost, there's no mindset that encourages us, because from early on, we're encouraged to pay attention, obey, fit in, and follow the leader. But what if the leader is wrong? What if what we've been told simply isn't true, or the whole picture? Well, we've been told, you know, we have checks and balances. We have experts. We have wise men and women from major universities, MIT and Stanford. These people have spent their adult lives mastering and studying. Now these people are parts of a puzzle. We bring them together, and we share that information in our textbooks, in our articles, in documentaries. So what are you going to put that against? And historically, they mocked the little old lady in tennis shoes. When I was growing up and I came into New York, you almost never saw older women in sneakers. You saw a lot of younger women in high heels that would later deform their feet, and it was painful, but it was fashionable. And the older ones were wearing, that you found at least into health, generally they just weren't wearing sneakers, but they had high-fiber diets. They frequently weren't taking vitamins, because vitamins weren't a part of the health movement until the mid-1970s. So what you had is you just generally had a high-protein diet with lots of fiber. The fiber was good, the high-protein was not, but they were very vigorous. And being vigorous and exercising and trying to be conscious about choices you're making, even if you have limited choices, is still healthier than a person who's not taking those. My mother told me something that I will paraphrase from long ago, and when I was deciding on a couple things, and the conversation she had built over about 4 or 5 years. And when I had my first best-selling book, her first comments were, just understand that if you're successful, it does not make you any better than anyone else. So you shouldn't live as if you are better or that you're exceptional. And I didn't quite understand it at the time, but later I would. And in one of our conversations, she said, "How do you make your decisions?" I said, "Well, I think about what I want to create or achieve, whether it's writing a book, whatever it is, and then I go ahead and do it." And she said, "Okay, what if you added this into that formula? What if you assume that with every choice you have, the opposite is always present?" I said, "Explain that." She said, "Well, the fact that some people after work have a martini or highball or whatever they were drinking at that time because they want to unwind from the day. So it becomes a ritual, and every day they have it. Now what happens when they're in their 40s and now they have liver dysfunction or kidney dysfunction or they have cancer or they have ulcers? How likely are they to go back and say, you know, that highball I had every day to unwind? And also it was socially acceptable. You socialize by having a drink. That's the first thing you did when you went to someone's home. You know, how many different varieties of alcohol did you have? What were the beverages of choice? And it wasn't for people to go someplace and socialize and get drunk. It was that which just was common. Everybody smoked. I remember when on every Sunday we would go to my Uncle George's home, and he was the, George Ludwig, he was the kind of the senior mind of all my father, mother's brothers and sisters. And he was a quiet person. He was an engineer. And he did very little talking. But when he said something, you listened. And other people just never shut up. They just gabbed on and on and on about nothing. And any problem that you gave him, he would think about it, and then he would give you a simple and straightforward solution. And more often than not, it was correct. Well, after the younger people, even if we were teenagers, we still had to, there was no room at the big table except for the eight or nine adults. And the rest of us ate in the kitchen, you know, where the kids were supposed to eat. Well, in any case, every single meal they finished, there were two principles that I saw. One, you had to eat everything in your plate. So even if it was an unhealthy food, you had to eat it all. And secondly, everyone began to smoke. And they didn't stop smoking because then they cleared the table and then they played canasta the rest of the day. The whole place smelled like cigarette smoke. So not only were we affected by secondhand smoke that nobody knew about, but this is what they did. It was a ritual. Nobody questioned it. They never questioned the highballs. They never questioned the smoking. And if anyone in that family had ever gotten drunk or on any public occasion or family occasion, which I never saw, but if they did, that would keep everyone from ever drinking. This kind of superstition that, look what happened to this guy. That could happen to any one of us, so let's just not drink. And that's the ethic that I saw. Now, here's what my mother was saying. Your aunt has diabetes, and she's overweight. And that was my Aunt Helen was my father's aunt and my favorite aunt because she always had such a great sense of humor. And she was very loving. She just overflowed with love. And my mom said, "Do you think that anything you're writing or anything knowledge you have will help her?" I said, "Well, I hope so." She said, "No. No matter who you go to in this family, they'll listen to you, but not one of them will do anything. We all saw you on Johnny Carson. It was the talk of the town. Oh, you're the first person from Parkersburg to ever end up on a national show like that." And she said, "Everybody was so proud of you." And then I just visualized it. I was visualizing everyone sitting around, having a highball, smoking cigarettes, just having eaten a gigantic meat and mashed potato and white bread, finishing off with a piece of cake or pie, a la mode. But they're watching Gary talk about health on Johnny Carson. So it was the fact that someone had some moderate success that this was what they celebrated, not the information and not themselves changing. So here's what my mother said, and I'd like you to think about this for a moment. And again, I'm paraphrasing. Every choice you make will provide you with a destination. It is unfortunate that you only learn the value of those choices when you reach a destination. So why not stop and really think, what is the likely outcome of my destination based upon the choices I'm making? That tied into what my mother was suggesting, that there are two possible, minimally, choices. And one can be constructive, one destructive. They're both going to get you to a destination. You're just going to have a really different outcome. And I never fully appreciated what my mother was saying until some years later. Now, just a little more digression on this, because I think it's important. People can relate to it. When I first got to New York, my friends were either artists who were struggling and unemployed, or there was one that was doing all right, Peter Max. We've been friends ever since. Long friendship. He's just a very special and beautiful soul. And my other friends were writers, and all of them had been published. And two of my friends who were writers had published 7 and 9 books respectively, novels. And they were living what you would consider a successful life. They both had co-ops, one on Weston Avenue, the other on Riverside. Now at that time, and for years, I had lived on 89th Street between Riverside and Weston Avenue in Manhattan. And I was in a 3-story brownstone, and I had a tiny little one-room apartment. When I say tiny, I mean tiny. But I was happy. I was only paying $57 a month rent. And every day I'd take my daughter, Shelley, down to Riverside Park, a half a block away, and there was a children's playground, and she'd go in and play with the other kids, and I would sit there. And that's where I did my writing. I did everything in longhand, notebook after notebook after notebook. And when they had computers, and that was the hottest thing, I'd sit there and marvel at these computers. And the first guy I ever knew to have a computer around me was Pat McGrady, Jr., great journalist, helped save a lot of lives with his alternative advice on cancer. But Carl and some of the other friends also had computers. I didn't, and they thought they'd come over, and it was as if they were embarrassed to come over my little tiny apartment. And I will never forget the day that there were 6 of us, and it was really too cramped in the apartment. So we walked over to Riverside Park, and there at 89th and Broadway was the Soldiers and Sailors Memorial. And you're able to look over the Hudson River for there. It's cool in the summertime. You can look north, and that was at George Washington Bridge. So it was kind of an idyllic place. Rich or poor, it was free just to sit in that commons. So we're talking about some serious issues. And one of the issues that I raised a question. I remember I raised this specifically to my friend Carl, and we were best of buddies. We hung out every day together, I said, Carl, I said, what do you attribute your best-selling, or not best-selling, but very popular novels to? And he said, my editor. I said, you mean she's like a Maxwell Perkins? No, not at all. No, Gary, in publishing, it's who you know, and if they like you, they're going to green light your projects. They're the ones who decide how much of an advance you're going to get or not. And as long as you've got a friend, an advocate, a support system in a publishing company, you can be there as long as they are. I said, what about if they leave, if they retire, if they're fired? Well, fortunately, that hasn't happened. I said, but you built your lifestyle upon for every dollar you make in an advance or royalty, you've already spent it on your lifestyle. Are you prepared to radically change your lifestyle if the circumstances in your life about publishing change? And he said, no. I said, why not? He said, well, I would then have to contend with explaining to my wife how we're going to have to get by on less. And then Steve, another writer friend of mine, says, Gary, you know, you're successful enough with 5 national best-selling books. You could afford a better place. I said, this is fine here because I've seen what happens to friends who overspend or live beyond their means. I don't intend to do that. Jump ahead 6 years. Boy, this was prophetic. 6 years after we had that conversation, every one of my 6 friends were broke. It started 2 years later, and I never will forget this, when one of my buddies, who was a very popular romance novelist, came over on a Saturday morning, and he was just nervous, and he said, I don't know what I'm about to do. My editor left and is retiring, and no one there is interested in my books. I'm going to bring their own people in. And Gary, I got all these expenses. Can you help me out? Just for a short period of time. And I said, sure, I will. You're my friend. I don't let my friends not get help. But I'm going to do this once. That's it. Once. And here's what I suggest you do in the interim. Get out of writing. Take the education you have and get back into something that allows you to sustain a life until such time that you can re-enter, and you better make yourself over because the industry is changing. And he was offended by that. I said, okay, well, what you do, it ultimately is you, but when I try to give you all some insight, you mock me. Now I'm sorry this happened to you, but it's going to happen to all of us. It's going to happen to me. I had a national best-selling book, sold over 1 million copies in hardback, and I didn't get a penny royalty. So, they're all saying, gee whiz, you're making $3 a royalty, that's $3 million bucks, wow, wow, wow. Not a penny, nothing. But because I had a low overhead, I could withstand that. It also taught me a lesson about trusting people in publishing, which I do not trust, and I have not since. So they all were forced out of publishing. My buddy Carl, I didn't see him for another 10 years, and I'm going up to my farm, and there, as I'm driving up the road I'm on, I see a guy working, but a completely different look. Long beard, long hair. And I thought, could that be Carl? And I got out and I walked over and it was Carl. And he said he was finally happy. And he truly was happy. He got out of the pressure cooker of trying to succeed and always being compared to everyone else in the marketplace. And your value as a human being is only what you can produce. And then you're having to do things you don't want to do, write things you're not happy about writing, just to succeed, just to keep your standard of living happening. Of course, all these people ended up in divorce, and he ended up being a school bus driver. He still had his sense of humor. He had his personality. He had his full character. In fact, he was a much better human being because he realized that you have choices, and now he understood that. We had a long talk that day about how many mistakes we all make because we don't look at the likely outcome of the choices we're making until we get to our destination and think, wow, boy, do I have buyer's remorse. Why didn't I do that instead of that? Why did I eat that instead of that? Why did I drink that instead of that? Why did I, take this medication instead of this nutrient? Why didn't I exercise instead of being lazy? All these things we could have and should have done, and we didn't. So when you're working in a health support group and you're working with people who have come because they're willing to make the radical change, the radical sacrifice, giving up their comforts, giving up the ritual of their day-to-day choices. But then they have this radical outcome, hyper-radical results. They've had disease, now they're cured. So when people ask, well, how's it done? Is there a simple protocol? There is no simple protocol. You have to make an enormous commitment. And that's why maybe 10% of the people who start a journey actually finish it. But when you finish it, you get to the end point, if you do it right, you're going to be happy with your life and the choices you've made. And that's what my mother was telling me. Everybody else doesn't think about the consequences of the choice they're making because those consequences are predetermined by your conditioning, the epigenetic conditioning of everyone and everything, good or bad, and it's generally a combination. And then one day we get to that destination. I could just imagine, and it ran through my mind many times, because every weekend when I drive up to the country, the Fertler Farm, because I was teaching, thousands and thousands and thousands of you came to the classes, over 10,000 people over the years. And I did that free. I gave classes on sustainability and organic gardening. It was the only teaching organic farm in all of New York State. And spending all day, either Saturday or Sunday, just showing people how to grow, how to cultivate, all the things that we take for granted now, we don't do. Because there's a convenience in not doing it. I can go buy it. Okay. It's not the same. But on my trip up there, I was thinking, gee whiz, if this was just 3 years ago, 5 years ago, today I'd be out there brainstorming with some buddies. Boy, how all that changed. And suddenly all those people who were in your life, a very important part of your life, central to your life, that chapter's over. You may have wanted it to continue, but the circumstances in life dictate and determine how long a chapter lasts and when the next one has to begin and whether or not did you learn the lessons of your choices. Unfortunately, most people don't. There's someone listening right now. His lifestyle led him to being on 17 different medications, near death, and grossly morbidly obese, and yet he wouldn't stop and change. Only when he would take a month, come down to my home and I'd help him get back. I'm going to change. But he never did. And recently, he called late at night. He was in the intensive care unit of a hospital, and he had been diagnosed with end stage congestive heart failure. And there's zero recovery from that. And I said, what do you expect? What do you expect with since not changing? He says, well, you're right. I should have changed, but I didn't. I fell back into my old habits. I said, but there's no more time to falling back in old habits. Well, if I just get one more chance, I'm going to do it. So I gave him a protocol that night, and he implemented it, and he got through the night. And then the next couple of days, he got through. And then suddenly, I no longer had congestive heart failure. I used the same protocol I did with Fred Fisher. Now, Fred Fisher just passed not long ago, passed about the same time that Alan Pressman passed. And Fred was near death. In fact, he would be dead. The doctor, his cardiologist, says, you're going to be dead. You can't be 729 pounds with congestive heart failure and at your age survive an operation. If you don't have the operation, you're definitely going to die. If you have the operation, there's high probability you'll die. And only then did he call. And then we went to work and we got him to lose, I think it was 325 pounds, dropped 300 points off his blood sugar, got his blood pressure normal, got his heart normal. And to his credit, Fred spent the next 20 years helping countless people make better choices. He was an extraordinarily loving, a determined individual. And he didn't cheat when he was on his protocol. It was 100%. In fact, when this producer heard about it on PBS, I believe it was in Detroit, they said, why don't you bring him with you? So I brought Fred, and he held up his pant, a pants belt before the protocol, and then looked at him now, you wouldn't have recognized the person. So could you imagine helping people every day free, as he did? So he was just a wonderful human being, and it was that last chapter of his life that ultimately became the most important chapter of his life. So he learned the lessons from previous mistakes, understood what the choices would bring when he got to destinations, and he made the right choices. But my other buddy, he's right back to the same unhealthy lifestyle. But the likelihood is him surviving a massive heart attack or stroke is just zero at this point. How many times are you knocking on death's door and one day death opens the door and says, come on in. You've been trying to get here for a long time. And then suddenly the person wakes up and says, well, hold on. No, I'm not ready. I'm not ready. I still got a whole lot to do. Well, hold on. You've had multiple times to get ready and do things and honor your life and provide a good legacy. And you've squandered it on needing to rescue people and needing to enable people. And so you've succeeded. You just don't like the reward. So think about that, because I thought about it all the time. What happened to my friends? What are they doing now? How did they handle the changes in their life? How were they too embarrassed by what they had to give up and sacrifice to even call me? I was still their friend. If you're a friend, you're a friend with someone in the best and worst of times. And frequently you only know who your true friends are on what happens when there's a crisis in your life. For half those people, I never found out. Don't know what happened to them, and life goes on. Only two of them did I find out. And so that's why we have to understand life is constantly changing. We're always moving, like it or not, deny it or not, we're moving towards the change of the chapter we're in. So when I read an article, and this article says that all you have to do is take an antioxidant, look at the remarkable improvement, and I'm thinking, that's one change out of 1,000. What if you implied, let's make a lot more changes? The more changes you suggest, the fewer people are going to be interested. So the truth of preventing disease and the truth of changing disease into health is relatively easy to understand. The complication is, are we prepared to make those changes? Well, that's all we have time for in our health and nutrition segment. I added these because these are real stories that were very important to me and still are important to me based upon the choices. I have to make a choice now. After a devastating hurricane that I'm still cleaning up, still out there every day, raking, cutting, trimming on a bobcat, saving. Yesterday we saved 12 trees. Hopefully today I'll save about 15 more. There are few won't be able to save, and that's the sad part, but all the other ones we have been able to save, over 95% of the downed trees I'm able to get back in whole. But we also had the worst fire, and had I not been prepared, this place would burn down. So the question is, what choice do I make now going forward? Remember, there's only so much preparation you can do to mitigate the outcome of a disaster. You don't change the disaster, you just change how long it'll take to recover and how much it will cost you and how much time and effort will be put into it. And what happens if I'm not there and not able to make instructions and do things like, if you got rescued animals, where are you going to put them? And so you have a gigantic pond and you get them all in the water because you know that the fire's not going to get them in the water. And then you turn the sprinkler system on. But what if I'm not there? What if I'm out? What if I can't make it back? So these are the changes I have to think about. I've got to do something, but I will think it through and think of all the options and the consequence of each option. This is what I was saying. You got to think through the likely outcome of every choice you make. And then at the end you say, okay, I will stay for another year, or it's time to find another location. Now, that in itself requires a lot of time, effort, energy, and money. But would you want to live in a place that you knew was going to have more disasters? Who would want to move to Puerto Rico, knowing that 3.4 million people are starving? They have no electricity and won't for months. They have no aid. We destroy their country because we didn't allow them to become independent. We didn't allow them to expand their agrarian society. We use it like a colony since it was made a U.S. protectorate, which means they are U.S. citizens. But we don't treat them with respect. We exploit them. And as a result, they have no plan B. So knowing there are going to be more storms and even worse storms, you're going to rebuild, and what's going to happen? So that's why I said we have to have a whole new mindset of where we should be living in the future. We're going to take a break and come back with something I think all of us need to hear. Please stay with us. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. Now we're going to hear from John Oliver on a segment that will take us up to the end of the show, but I think we need to hear it. It's about what's happened to our society where we're not paying attention. The monopolization of everything. And that means instead of having, let's say, 2,000 different news outlets 50 years ago, now we really have about 7 that controls most of American media. And we need to know this because these are the people who have control over everything. Now, John Oliver.
The point is, all this merger activity has helped make some sectors of our economy ridiculously consolidated.
The United States has gone from having 10 large airlines back in 2000 to just 4 today. And those 4 mega airlines now dominate more than 80% of the U.S. market.
Yeah, we're down to just 4 major airline choices. And no, that does not include JetBlue, because that is not actually an airline. It's just a very expensive way to eat those weird blue chips, which are, and this is true, just sliced Grover arms. Look, and airlines here are just the beginning. The rental car business is now 90% dominated by just 3 companies. The US beer industry is 70% controlled by just 2 companies. And online search engines are, of course, as we all know, dominated by 1 major player. That's right, say it with me, Bing. That's right, Bing, the best way to Google something. In fact, look, full disclosure here, even our own parent company, Time Warner, is currently trying to merge with AT&T, which makes this story a little dangerous for us to do. Although, you know, that is presuming that AT&T executives managed to get the service working long enough to see it. AT&T, it's the top telecom company around, alphabetically, and nothing else. Even some brands that you might think of as indie now have multinational owners. Burt's Bees? It's not run by a backwards Bert, it's run by Clorox. Toms of Maine, the deodorant which did so little to deodorize your freshman year roommate, that's now owned by Colgate Palmolive. And then there is Goose Island. Now, their ads feature beardy brewers rubbing hops on their faces. But what they don't mention is that Goose Island is owned by Anheuser-Busch, and that farm that you just saw is located at 822 Budweiser Loop. It's presumably just past Bud Light Limerita Boulevard. Basically, if you see the mass grave of Clydesdale horses, turn left and you're there. And it says something about the rapid rate of mergers that even Jim Cramer occasionally finds himself in disbelief at one happening. Watch him react to a mega merger in the aluminum can industry.
Ball Corp's acquisition of Rexam is taking the number of competitors in this space down to, get this, from 3 to 2. They let that happen.
Yeah. It's not great when a business casual Louis C.K. with a sound effects board is saying, holy, this was a really bad idea. But But how did they let that happen is actually a really good question, and the answer is interesting. Because we have had antitrust laws on the books for more than a century. And I'm not saying that every single merger is bad. You know, sometimes businesses getting bigger can lead to greater efficiencies and improvements. The tension is between allowing that and preventing them from doing real harm. So it's a balance. But since the late 1970s, that balance has tipped decidedly in favor of being merger-friendly, which has led to real problems. And let's start with the obvious. For workers, mergers can often mean big layoffs. But it's not just employees that can suffer, consumers can too, as Jim Cramer explained in that aluminum can segment in an inexplicably sarcastic tone of voice.
I always say competition, while great for you, a consumer, is an anathema to profits. Sometimes a business will be a total monopoly with no competition whatsoever. And while that's the ideal, it's very rare to see a genuine monopoly because, of course, it's against the law. Which brings us to the next best thing, an oligopoly, where a handful of companies control an entire industry, coexisting peacefully without much in the way of price competition.
That's a weird tone to use to describe something that's clearly awful. It's rare to see genuine bestiality because, of course, it's against the law. Which brings us to the next best thing, having sex with a stuffed animal while looking at pictures of a real horse. And for a sense of what it can look like when a handful of companies coexist peacefully without much in the way of price competition, just look at airlines. In 2012, one airline executive told an industry conference, consolidation has allowed us to do things like ancillary revenues, which is jargon for all those fees that drive you crazy. Now, American was the first major airline to charge you for your first checked bag back in 2008. And back then, people could not believe it.
American Airlines will soon charge $15 for the first checked bag. That's on top of a fee of $25 for your second one.
$15? Holy cow. I'll have to put my underwear in my pockets.
Yes. First, that is clearly a delightful man. Although it does make you wonder whether he fills his bags full of underwear and nothing else. But within months, most major airlines had followed American's lead, and it was essentially the industry standard. And it is easy for that to happen when there's only a handful of big players. In fact, since then, they've added and increased bag fees multiple times, often moving in tandem, which is how those fees have gone from generating around $540 million a year a decade ago to $4.2 billion now. And that is infuriating. After all, if I wanted exorbitant fees that keep getting raised all the time despite shitty service, I'd become a customer of AT&T. Yeah, AT&T, even if you take over, you'll never be my real dad! And look, you may well be angry with the service you get from airlines, but thanks to consolidation, they don't really need to give a shit about what you think. And if you don't believe me, remember that awful video that went around earlier this year?
The shocking images of a passenger caught in a travel nightmare. A man visibly shaken as he's yanked and then dragged off a United jet by law enforcement, all after refusing to give up his seat.
Yeah, that is the most horrifying thing you can possibly see on an airplane, unless your in-flight movie is The Boss Baby. A movie that combines the unbearable smugness of Alec Baldwin with the unbearable smugness of a baby. Now, in the wake of that incident, people said it was a PR nightmare and there was talk on Twitter of boycotting United. The problem is, on certain routes, they're the only option. So a boycott is going to be pretty hard to pull off. And that is arguably why their CEO was later able to open his earnings call for that quarter by describing a period in which, I will remind you, a passenger had his teeth knocked out on one of United's planes like this.
Welcome to a terrific second quarter, strong financial results and even more incredible operational results. And as we think about customers, I want to thank them for their continued loyalty and support. We continue to find new and better ways to service them and make them more comfortable on our airline.
And you know what? Is it really any wonder that their earnings stayed solid? United is sometimes the only way to get to where you are going, which actually explains their new slogan, "All a play to Houston, shut up and get in." And when an industry gets too consolidated, any company trying to compete with them or survive in their supply chain can get crushed. Now, we all know about Amazon, Walmart, or Google, but there are less obvious examples of this too. Take eyewear. Now, if you go into a lens crafter's, you will see frames by brands like Prada, Dolce & Gabbana, Burberry, and Ralph Lauren, all of which, it turns out, are made by an Italian company called Luxottica, which incidentally also owns Lens Crafters and Sunglass Hut and Pearle Vision and runs Target Optical and Sears Optical. So what can happen when a smaller company goes up against them? Well, just ask Oakley.
Oakley was a big competitor, and they had a fight with Luxottica, and Luxottica basically said, we're dropping you from our stores. And Oakley,
they refused to sell their glasses?
Yeah,
in their
it was a dispute about pricing, and they dropped Oakley from the stores, and Oakley's stock price collapsed.
There were some issues between the two companies in the beginning of the 2000s, but both of them understood that it was better to go along. We merged with Oakley in 2007.
You bought
so
Oakley.
We're talking...
They tried to compete, and they lost, and then you bought them.
I understand your theory, but they understood that life was better together.
Oof. That is the menacing tone of a Bond villain. They understood life was better together, Mr. Bond, no? That is the first time that I have ever felt sorry for Oakley, the official sunglasses of guys who unironically use the... And I think it's a sponsorship deal. And there is one more victim of consolidation that you may not think about, and that is the products themselves. Because heavily consolidated industries can lose the incentive to innovate. And the best example of this may be the cable box beneath your TV. If you have one of those, you probably hate it because it's huge, it's glitchy, and it may be one of the largest energy-consuming items in your house, even when it's turned off. But if you think about it, cable companies have no real incentive to improve them. They're essentially regional monopolies. And again, they know that you basically have nowhere else to go. And you can't even smash your cable box out of frustration because you are renting it, and they'll then charge you hundreds of dollars if you don't give it back. Point here is, we seem to have forgotten how important antitrust is and are now all being forced to live with the consequences. Because this issue affects almost everything you do. Angry at banks? Well, the industry is dominated by just these four. Frustrated with your health insurance provider? Odds are it's one of these. And if this whole story is infuriating you so much that you are yearning for the sweet escape of death, well, bad luck, because the casket industry is controlled by these three companies. Oh, and it gets even worse. The afterlife is actually controlled by one religion. I'm not saying which one, but when you find out, you're going to be so mad. The point is, we have laws to prevent the worst effects of consolidation, and it may well be time to more aggressively use them to impose stricter standards and to empower the FTC and the DOJ's antitrust divisions. And that is something that most people would really get behind, and nearly every politician should. After all, there is one thing they cannot stop saying.
Small business is the backbone of our economy.
Well, if they really believe that, it may be time for them to stop talking about backbones and grow one. And now, this.
And now, all of Jim Cramer's sound buttons replaced with fart noises.
Hedge funds that are in trouble start selling, not because they want to, but because they have to raise money to pay back their unhappy clients. Things keep working out. Is it any wonder that Norfolk Southern and Union Pacific keep running? Buy high and then sell low. A time-honored way to lose money. Sell it tomorrow. Because the whole idea of saving for retirement puts you to sleep. But I want you to feel emboldened. Not as we tell you what we would do before we pull any trigger. I was wrong on both counts.
That's it for today. I want to thank you all for listening in. Look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day, everyone.
At first I was afraid, I was petrified. Kept thinking I could never live without you by my side. But then I spent so many nights thinking how you did me wrong. I grew strong and I learned how to get along. So now you're back from outer space. I just walked in to find you here with that sad look upon your face. I should have changed that stupid lock. I should have made you leave your key.